Good morning. So, welcome back to day two, or welcome to day one for those of you who weren't here yesterday. I want to thank Jane. We changed everything on her. Walked in this morning and did a beautiful job on the bells, because yesterday my work job was to go through and blow in and blow out, trying just to get us all to be doing the same service, which I know the Jihon Sanchi this morning blew everybody out. I apologize. But it is the case, if we're going to do Japanese, that the way the morning service always ends is with the All Buddha's Ten Directions three times in the Japanese. So it's fine with me if we someday decide we don't want to do any Japanese. I would really understand that. But we can't be doing the schizo thing of sometimes doing it and sometimes not. So at least for the time being, we'll keep it in. This is actually the difficulty for us. And it takes about 100 years for the practice to completely synthesize with whatever culture it comes to. And so when it went from India to China, it took about 100 years, and when it went from China to Japan, and you know, now in the West. And Suzuki Roshi acknowledged this in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. He said, you know, what's really clear to me is that you really want a practice. He'd come from Japan, where basically lay people just don't sit. A little bit more now. It's like we're taking it back to them. But when he was there, it was basically, it was a job. It was the temple priest sent his eldest son off to Eheji. They got 3 years of being whacked on the head, got their brown robe, came home, and took over the family business. It's not that way for us. First of all, there is no family business. Second of all, I can't imagine any of us going off for 3 years to get whacked on the head. And it's pretty brutal. I mean, they bark at you there all the time. So Western culture is going to have to find its way, and we're only about halfway through that 100 years. And he said, who knows, you know, maybe someday you'll give up these robes altogether. Who knows, maybe you'll be wearing blue denim. We'll all be wearing jeans or robes made out of it, although I hope not, it's much too heavy. So yesterday we started with the poem by Ryokan. Talk is easy. Talk is always easy. Practice always hard. But we got to this statement by Suzuki Roshi. Zazen practice and everyday activity are one thing. We call Zazen everyday life, and everyday life Zazen. But usually we think, ah, now Zazen is over, and we will go about our everyday activity. This is not right understanding. They are the same thing. We have nowhere to escape. So Zazen practice and everyday activity are one thing. They are the same thing. If we separate out the activities of our daily life from this thing we do on our cushion, Suzuki Roshi says that is not right understanding. You're doing something, but you are actually not doing Zen practice. So because all of us, myself included, work in some way, sometimes it's outside the home, sometimes it's inside the home, it is all valuable work. But all activity, all day long, requires this mind that we are experiencing on the cushion. And why do I say it requires it? Because fundamentally, when you look at all the precepts, when you look at the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, the fundamental message is harmony. Why else is right speech important? Because we would like to create harmony. You can look at the negative. You can say, because we'd like to not cause harm. And the fact is, we cause harm all day long without intending to. Just getting in your car, thousands of insects give their life. And you may think, oh, it's just this little tiny bug. But for that bug, its life was all it had. So we can't really help causing harm, because everything that lives, lives because something else dies. Even if you're a vegetarian, you know, once you cut that cabbage off, that's it. It's dying. You know that wonderful smell of the grass after it's been mowed? It's bleeding to death. That's what you're smelling. You're smelling grass blood. Okay. It's a wonderful smell, and for most of us it evokes very positive memories. But, you know, when you think about it that way, it's like, oh. For everything to live, everything must die. It's just one big circle. And when we see it that way, we understand a little more about death, and we don't get quite so upset about it. This is the natural course of things. But in this little blip on the screen we call life, we would like to live it as completely as possible. So what gets in our way? That's where we're going to start today. What is it that keeps me from taking this mind that I develop so assiduously on this cushion? What keeps me from being able to take it through my day in a seamless way? Well, it was funny because it's not even in my notes, but I realized there's one big piece I was leaving out when I was thinking about this. There is a belief system that we all have to some degree or not. And the belief system is, oh, that's not my job. So you're walking down the street and you see a piece of trash. Well, I didn't leave it there. And you walk on. Most people do that. But it really doesn't matter whether it's your trash or not. It's not in the right place. So there's this man who lives near Stanford University, which is about a 25-minute drive to my house. And those of you who have been to my house know that I live on the top of a small mountain that has an incline like this for 3 miles. This man bicycles from Stanford University to the top of my hill pretty much every day. That alone at the age of 70 plus would be impressive. Legs of steel. But that isn't the impressive thing. The impressive thing is that as he's going along, he stops and he picks up trash. He's got a bag on his bicycle. And he just stops all along the way and he picks up trash. So maybe he gets to go, you know, a quarter of a mile and then he stops and he picks up. And then maybe he only gets to go 20 feet and he stops. If you've ever ridden a bicycle going uphill, stopping is not what you want to do. You want to get some momentum to keep going. But this is his practice. And he does it every day. It's just blows my mind, actually. And he doesn't really like it when people stop to say thank you. You know, those of us who live on the hill, because it's a route that many people take to go over to the beach. So it's sort of a scenic route, which means there are a lot of people who throw their trash out the window along the way. So for those of us who live there, this is really quite an amazing offering. Because, you know, the city doesn't have enough money to come every single day and pick up trash. So he just does it because it's not his job. But he sees it, and it needs to be taken care of. So yesterday I was noticing, and using both the downstairs and the upstairs bathroom, those little hand towels that are there. Sometimes I would come in and they would be neatly folded. Other times I would come in and they would just be very carelessly thrown over the rack. Now it might be that when you walked in, it was already thrown carelessly over the rack. And you thought, oh, well, I guess that's the way it's supposed to be. Or it might be that you thought to yourself, oh well, and you just wiped your hands and walked out. But our practice is, oh, I'm going to make this nice for the next person. I know how the towels are supposed to be. You wipe your hands, you take the towel, you fold it, and you put it back. So I've been sitting here for almost a day now, and there's this little stone here, and it's been here since yesterday morning. And I thought about picking it up, and then I thought, well, I'm just gonna see what happens here. So either we're not seeing it, which is one kind of problem, or we're thinking it's not my job to pick it up, which is a different problem. Both things are problems for us. If we're not seeing something like that in the middle of a clean floor zendo, we're not paying attention to our environment. You cannot just sit on your cushion and put blinders on. Your job is open awareness of everything. But if you did look at it and figured someone else would take care of it, that's not right understanding either. Everything is your job. When you see something that can be taken care of, you do it. This is true in the zendo. It's true in your job. It's true in your home. If you're waiting for your husband to put away the container of milk on the counter, you might wait a very long time and the milk will go sour. If you are waiting for your wife to take down her underwear that's been drying on the rack in the bathroom, you might be waiting for a very long time. If there's something that you can do, do it. That's our practice. So the second thing that gets in our way always, and I know you talked about this recently because it comes up in that Dogen fascicle about studying the way, is about being goal-oriented, gaining idea. So Suzuki Roshi says, you know, usually when you do something, you want to achieve something. You attach to some result. Our effort in practice should be directed from achievement to non-achievement. From achievement to non-achievement means to be rid of the unnecessary and bad results of effort. He's not saying effort is the problem, the bad results of effort. If you do something in the spirit of non-achievement, there is a good quality in it. If you just walk into the bathroom and you're not even using the towels, but you see that they're not folded correctly, you just do it. You don't worry that someone's going to come and say, oh, thank you so much for folding those towels. You just do it. So just do something with any particular effort is enough. When you make some special effort to achieve something, some excessive quality, some extra element is involved in it. Well, what's that extra element? It's either you want to get praised, or you're very proud of yourself. Oh, didn't I do a nice job with the towels? It's so small, but it comes up. Oh, I did a really good job today cleaning the zendo. Pat myself on the back. This is not to say that we can't feel good about stuff. But it means that feel good about it and then let it go. Non-attachment. All of those precepts, that's all it's about. You know, that one about no anger. It doesn't mean you're not going to have any anger. It doesn't mean anger is not going to arise. It means don't hold on to it. Don't be attached to it. And if you kill 1,000 bugs on your way here in your car, offer a little bow of gratitude to them for giving their life sincerely, and then go on. So, years ago, before I understood about Orioke, which for those of you who don't know is the formal eating method in zendos and monasteries where you have three bowls and a set of chopsticks and a spoon and what's called a setsu, which is a version of a little tiny spatula. It's a very self-contained eating style. It's quite wonderful because the only thing you have to have is somebody serving you food. Nobody has to wash any dishes because that's part of the ceremony, is washing your bowls while they're right there. Hot water comes to you and you drink the hot water. And you might go, ooh, but it's just food. And it's your food. You know? So by the time you're done, your dishes are completely clean, dry, back in the bowl, and that's that. Well, it turns out that there are also specific things about the meals themselves. And dinner is considered to be medicine. Now, we're not as strict as the Theravadins. They don't eat after 12. But we have a meal, a dinner meal, but only two bowls. One bowl contains gruel. One bowl is some vegetable or salad. Okay. Now, gruel, I'm teasing about that. It's really what we call Tenzo surprise. The Tenzo has to be very clever because they have to take all of the leftovers from how many ever days before and mix them into something totally delicious. And the amazing thing is, every single night, this happens. Any Tenzo who knows what they're doing, and any Tenzo even who doesn't, I mean, everybody starts out not knowing what they're doing. It's just amazing what you can do with grain. So, Tenzo surprises in the first bowl. And often it's using leftover soup, leftover beans, leftover rice, whatever is left, vegetables. A couple times I've had gruel that was a little odd, but, you know. Overall, 90% of the time, great food. So I'm fairly new, and making vichyssoise was one of my specialties. So I had signed up to bring vichyssoise for lunch, and I had really taken a lot of care because we used to make things ahead of time and bring them, and that helped preparation around the meals. I mean, you still have to go through all of the heating it up and making a salad and making a grain, but having the soup already made was a good idea. So I bring this soup, and I'm really proud of it, and I'm thinking, oh, I hope Les likes this, you know, this is so good. So we have it for lunch, and I'm pretty sure he likes it. But there's a reasonable amount left, and I'm thinking, great, some to take home. This is wonderful. Well, there's a young man there who, frankly, I never saw before because he was from some other place, some other center, and I never saw him again. It's just as well. Because he was in charge of dinner and apparently said he knew how to do this. And he took my beautiful vichyssoise and he mixed it with all this other stuff. And when the dinner came out and there was Tenzo's surprise, I was the one who was surprised because there was my lovely soup all messed up with this other stuff. How dare he use my soup? I had gotten so attached to my soup so attached to how beautifully I had made it, that the idea that it was going to be used for gruel, just, oh, I was in a rage. Well, who's suffering? Everybody else in the room is thinking, wow, this is great gruel, right? Not me. So the real problem with goal-oriented work is not having a goal. It's that we usually can't let go of the goal. So you're going along in your job, and somebody comes in and they say, oh, well, this happens to my husband at eBay all the time. Guess what? We're not going to do this project anymore, even though you've worked on it for 12 months. Sorry, we think this project's more important. Could you work over here? What? Because, of course, we'd like to see our project come to completion. We'd like to see this thing that we did today come to completion. We'd like anything to be able to come to completion. And often it just doesn't. Life happens. Can you let go of your goal and turn to the new thing with equanimity? All right, so one of the next things that happens is we lose our beginner's mind. We get to know the service so well, and then someone comes along and they change it all, and we're thinking, oh my God, what's going on? But she did great this morning. She allowed beginner's mind to just come forth and, okay, I'll hit whatever bell you tell me to hit. Great. That was lovely. It was a lovely example. So I went to Tassajara with two different groups this summer. Tassajara is the Zen monastery in California. It was the first Zen monastery in the United States, actually. And we've been wanting to go as a group for a while. We used to go very regularly, and then we backed off for a couple of reasons. But this year, everybody was really ready to go. And I could only take 7 people each time. That's all they had room for doing what's called guest student practice. So you're a student working in the morning with all the other students there. And then in the afternoon, you are a guest. But in our case, what that meant was we had time to do study discussion of Dogen's The Study of the Way. So in the morning, after you do your morning sitting, and then you have the long morning service, just like here, you walk out of the zendo, and the Eno is standing there to assign you your really small little soji job. Soji just sort of means temple sweeping. And often you are assigned to go to the kitchen because they need just small amounts of chopping and things like that to be done. So on this one morning, I was assigned to the kitchen, and my senior student in California, Jill, was also assigned to the kitchen. And by the time I get all these robes off, I'm usually one of the last people to arrive in the kitchen. And so that was the case this day. When you get there, you wash your hands, and then you put on a dirty apron. That's all they have. Their washing machine had broken down. So one of the jobs ended up being washing the aprons. Anyway, so you put this apron on, and you go to the center of the kitchen where there is a huge, it's like what Patty and Janie have upstairs, except it's 3 times bigger. And they have something ready for you to do. Well, on this day, they had halves of acorn squash that had already been baked, so it's soft. And what they wanted you to do was scoop out as much as you could from the acorn squash and put it in one of those giant plastic, drywall mud comes in. Okay, that's what they, I mean, there's so many people that they have to feed. They have to do 6 meals a day, 3 for the guests and 3 for the students. Students don't eat with the guests. So these enormous big plastic containers. So by the time I arrive, Jill is standing across from me, and there's a woman standing next to her and a woman standing next to me. I watch what Jill is doing. The Tenzo's assistant explains what we're doing, but then walks away. Well, I watch what Jill is doing, and she's doing what the person next to her is doing, and so I start doing it too, like a sheep. We're taking our long spoon and we're getting all this stuff out. And then we go over and we go, on the side of the container to get it off because it's sticking to the spoon. So, whack, whack, whack. Four people whacking away. Finally, the Tenzo's assistant comes up and says very quietly, please use another spoon to get the squash off your spoon so that you don't have to make that sound. I'm so busy following what the other person is doing, who is following what the other person is doing, who is no doubt following what the other person is doing, that we've lost our beginner's mind. We're not thinking about harmony in that big way, because harmony is not going in a quiet kitchen. If I had thought about it for a moment, I would have realized, but instead, I'm just doing what everyone else is doing, and I'm afterwards thinking, I can't believe I did that. We need to be paying attention, not just to what others are doing, but what is the harmonious way to do it for the entire environment? And I lost sight of that. Okay. Another thing that we forget is about following through. This is about honoring the beginning and the middle and the end of each process. So yesterday, I think I took our work leader a little by surprise, because we had the beginning, which is we all come together and we talk about the work that needs to be done. And either we assign the work or we ask for volunteers, and the work leader or the person at your job explains where the tools are. That's the beginning. The beginning is coming together first with whoever you're working with. If you're not working with anyone, if you're working with yourself, like I do in my library a lot, you still take that moment to take a breath. You gather your materials, and you have a beginning. And you acknowledge that it's the beginning. This is why we offer incense at the various altars. It's the beginning. The beginning of the meal, we offer incense. The beginning of sitting, we offer incense. This is just to acknowledge this is the beginning. We acknowledge each individual that we're working with. Then there's the middle. That's the actual job. And we try to do that with our complete attention. And then there's the end. And that's the part I think took her by surprise, which I said, could we all come back and meet again at the end? We need to have resolution. So we all come back and we thank each other by bowing. Before we come back, the other part of the end is we look at our tools, see if they need to be cleaned. We put them back. I cannot tell you how many times I have tripped over a broom that someone has left outside my house after work practice in the morning. They swept. They did a nice job sweeping even, and then they left the broom. It's like, that's not work practice. Sweeping is just one part of it. It's the beginning, the middle, and the end. So then we come back and we see each other again and we thank each other for our practice. Then we're actually done. That's following through. So this is a really great story. You may have heard this before, but there's this wonderful book called Novice to Master. And it's this young Japanese monk who is the one ending up writing the book, Morinaga Roshi. And he's talking about how he starts out at this temple with this master, and he's pretty ambivalent. He's not even really sure he wants to be there. And there's only Morty Naga Roshi and the master there. So the very first day, the master sets him the task of raking the leaves up in the monastery. And as he said, Zen monasteries are built so that there will be many leaves. They just designed them that way. There's lots of trees, and the trees are supposed to have leaves that shed because it's supposed to honor the seasons then, right? So there he is, he's raking up all the leaves, and finally he's got this enormous pile. And he comes to the teacher and he says, "So, what do I do with this trash?" "Trash? Trash?" That's right. That's exactly what he said. Woof. He said, "In people and things, there is no such thing as trash." Well, yeah. And the guy's a little taken aback. He's not sure what to make of this. But Roshi, well, so what do I do with the pile of leaves? He rephrases it. Roshi's just, "Go to the bathhouse. There are sacks there. Bring the sacks." So he goes off and he's muttering to himself, "Crazy old man, maybe I won't be staying here after all. Well, okay, so maybe fine, we can do something with the leaves, but what about all the other stuff in the pile, the sticks and the stones and the moss and the, you know, that surely is trash." So he's convincing himself of this. So he goes off and he gets the sacks and he comes back and they fill the sacks up, they stuff them in completely, and then the teacher says, "Now take those sacks back to the bath and we will use them to heat up the bath later." Oh. Guess those aren't trash after all. Okay. But still there's that other stuff. When he comes back though, here's the Roshi sifting through all the other stuff. The stones are kind of falling out. The sticks are coming up. There's just little tiny pieces. And the big pieces have gone in the sacks. And there's little pieces of moss. And he starts pulling all the stones sort of off to one side. He says, "Take these stones and put them at the bottom of all the rain gutters." So he picks up these piles, and sure enough, at the rain gutters, because the rain, when it comes, it really pushes everything away. There are like these little blank spaces there. So he starts filling in all the holes with the little stones, but still he's thinking to himself, "Yeah, but what about all that little moss and stuff like that? That's got to be trash." He comes back, and there's the Roshi. He's picked up all this stuff, little tiny pieces of moss, and, you know, and he's sticking it in little places along the path that are bald. Every little place around the rocks where, you know, maybe it's just bare dirt, he's setting it in. And by the time they're done, nothing left of the pile. And then he turns to him. And as he said, this was his very first lesson. He turns, he says, "So, do you see now? In people and things, there is no such thing as trash." There's a beginning. There's a middle. There's an end. And part of it is about the job, but more of it is about the people. Everything, when work practice, when your life is seamless, it includes everything and everyone. If it does not include everyone, then your idea about no self is lacking in understanding. It cannot possibly not include everything, because there is no separate you. You are everything and related to it. One of the last things that is related to this is we forget to pay attention to who is in front of us right now. How many times have you been talking to someone and they're looking at you, but you can, you know, it's like you can see they're not really listening. They're either thinking of the response they're going to have to you, that you can see. You can feel the impatience. And you can, it's like it's going across their forehead. Ah, well, this is what I think. And when she's done talking, finally, I'll be able to tell her. Oh. But then there really is just sort of the blank. So Suzuki Roshi said, when you listen to someone, you should give up all your preconceived ideas, all your subjective opinions. You should just listen to her. Just observe her way. That's the way we put very little emphasis on right or wrong, or good and bad. We just see things as they are with him or her and accept them. And this is how we communicate with each other. If I'm already deciding you're wrong, or you're bad, or you've misunderstood, or I'm getting defensive because I feel like you're saying something bad about me or accusing me of misunderstanding, I'm already lost. You are already lost. We are lost. So years ago, I had an experience with my sister on the phone. It had to do with my mother's will and who was executor. And I knew fully well from my mother that it was my older brother, but that my sister had been sort of added in later as if something happened to him, she would be the next. And the reason I knew this was that my parents had talked to me and said, we really wanted it to be you, but we knew your older sister would be very unhappy, and we knew you wouldn't care. I said, you're right, I don't. I don't care about any of it. So do what's right. Do what will make everybody happy. But we're having this conversation, and she is insisting that she is the executor. And rather than hearing what she really needed me to hear, all I could hear was that she was wrong. And she kept talking, and she wouldn't let me say anything. She just kept, she doesn't take verbal cues very well. But I was getting angry and wanting her to hear what I had to say. So finally I said, would you please shut up for a moment so that I can say something? It took a year to undo that one outburst. All she wanted from me was to say, well, of course you're involved in the will. You're the eldest sister. We value you. It didn't matter. Someday when my mother dies, it's going to be written right there. Why argue about it? Well, maybe I could go to my mother later and say, I think she has a misunderstanding. You might want to talk to her about that. But no, 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 I had to be right. I had to let her know that she was wrong. And because of other causes and conditions, I finally lost my temper, and my sister turns out to be a very fragile person. She looks really strong on the outside, but it's really true that inside she's not. She also looks up to me. And I was the last person she expected that from. And it was like I had slapped her. It took a lot of apologizing. A lot. My mother finally actually had to lock her in her car and drive her around and tell her she was not unlocking the car until she was willing to at least speak to me on the phone. Which she finally did. And I have to say, it's been many years and things are really, really good. between me and my sister now. We have to listen to what's not being said. It's like the notes in music. The notes are wonderful, but it's actually the space in between that makes the music. We need to be paying attention. And that is why Ryokan says, talk is always easy. Practice is hard. Because you think to yourself, well, nobody else is paying attention all the time. Why should I? It's hard to pay attention all the time. Well, guess what? That's Zen practice. That's what you signed up for. Welcome. It is hard. And at the same time, it is the most delightful, beautiful work of art that you can create with your life. Because that's the amazing thing. You can do this. You have the ability to do this. And when you pay attention to each of these kinds of little details, and believe me, it is all in the details. It's not this big blissed out, oh, the world is beautiful. It doesn't work that way. It's how you sit down on your cushion. I'm sure you've noticed this, that when you've been sitting in Zazen for a while, you all start to bow together. Rather than just turning to your cushion and bowing and then sitting down, what you find is you begin to wait for the extra second for the other person to get ready, and then you both bow together. Until finally, at the end of 7 days, everybody is just in complete unison. You all bow differently, but you're all bowing together. That's why we do service. Service is our way of, we're doing this individual thing on our cushion, but then we turn around and we see each other. And we are so glad to see each other. You may go away now and you might think, well, if I'm not there on Saturday, other people will be there, it's okay. Or if I don't go on Tuesday or Thursday, whatever it is, other people will be there. Other people are not you. Whenever one of my Sangha is not there, oh, it's like a little hole. And I remind myself, well, look at all the other people who are here, but I miss that person. All of you mean everything to each other. Because practice is hard. And it's so good to know that there's a few other people in the universe who understand what you're trying to do with your life. How you are trying to wake up. That's all. So today, please continue your wonderful practice. Please notice the way you stand up, the way you sit down, the way you walk, the way you stand in line for the toilet. Please notice the towels. Notice the stone. Do whatever it takes to be here for everyone, but not least of all, be here for you.